Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
In the absence of our teacher today, I was thinking of what I might offer you in terms of encouragement for our practice. And I decided to please myself by reading some of my favorite Zen stories I'm going to read. And then I will also give all of you a little information about what Jukai is. And I took the precepts last year, and I'll just describe it a little so that you know what that is. And when you see people wearing a rakusu, what does that mean? Okay? So 101 Zen Stories was first published in 1939. And these stories recount actual experiences of the Chinese and Japanese Zen teachers over a period of more than 5 centuries. The first Zen patriarch, Bodhidharma, brought Zen to China from India in the 6th century. According to his biography recorded in the year of 1004 by the Chinese teacher Dogon, after 9 years in China, Bodhidharma wished to go home and gathered his disciples about him to test their perceptions. Dofuku said, "In my opinion, truth is beyond affirmation or negation, for this is the way it moves." Bodhidharma replied, "You have my skin." The nun Soji said, "In my view, it is like Ananda's sight of the Buddha land, seen since and forever." Bodhidharma answered, "You have my flesh." Daiku said, "The 4 elements of light, airiness, fluidity, and solidity are empty, and the 5 skandhas are no things. In my opinion, no thing is reality." Bodhidharma commented, "You have my bones." Finally, Hika bowed before the master and remained silent. Bodhidharma said, "You have my marrow." Old Zen was so fresh, it became treasured and remembered. Here are the fragments of its skin, flesh, bones, but not its marrow, never found in words. The directness of Zen has led many to believe it stemmed from sources before the time of Bodhidharma, 500 before the Common Era. The reader may judge for himself, for he has here, for the first time in one book, the experiences of Zen, the mind problems, the stages of awareness, and a similar teaching predating Zen by centuries. The problem of our mind relating to pre-conscious awareness takes us deep into everyday living. This is interesting. The problem of our mind relating conscious to pre-conscious awareness takes us deep into everyday living. Dare we open our doors to the source of our being? What are flesh and bones for? Probably some of you have heard some of these stories before, because in Dharma talks, teachers like to recount them. Ryokan, a Zen master, lived the simplest kind of life in a little hut at the foot of a mountain. One evening, a thief visited the hut, only to discover there was nothing to steal. Ryokan returned and caught him. You may have come a very long way to visit me," he told the prowler, "and you should not return empty-handed. Please take my clothes as a gift." The thief was bewildered. He took the clothes and he slunk away. Ryokan sat naked, watching the moon. "Poor fellow," he mused. "I wish I could give him this beautiful moon." Muddy Road. Tanzen and Ikido were once traveling together down a muddy road. A heavy rain was still falling. Coming around a bend, they met a lovely girl in a silk kimono and sash.
unable to cross the intersection. "Come on, girl," said Tanzan at once, lifting her in his arms. He carried her over the mud. Ikido did not speak again until that night when they reached the lodging temple. Then he could no longer restrain himself. "We monks don't go near females," he told Tanzan, "especially not young and lovely ones. It is dangerous. Why did you do that?" "I left the girl there," said Tanzan. "Are you still carrying her?" Not far from Buddhahood, a university student, while visiting Gassan, asked him, "Have you ever read the Christian Bible?" "No," said Gassan. "Read it to me." The student opened the Bible and read from St. Matthew. "And why take ye thought for raiment? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. And yet I say unto you that even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of them. Take therefore no thought for the morrow, for the morrow shall take thought for the things of itself." Gassan said, "Whoever wrote those words, I consider an enlightened man." The student continued reading, "Ask, and it shall be given you. Seek, and you shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. For everyone that asketh, receiveth, and everyone that seeketh, findeth. And to him that knocketh, it shall be opened." Gassan remarked, "This is excellent. Whoever said that is not far from Buddhahood." The Stone Mind. Hogen, a Chinese Zen teacher, lived alone in a small temple in the country. One day, four traveling monks appeared and asked if they might make a fire in his yard and warm themselves. While they were building the fire, Hogen heard them arguing about subjectivity, objectivity. He joined them and said, "There's a big stone. Do you consider it to be inside or outside your mind?" One of the monks replied, "From the Buddhist viewpoint, everything is an objectification of mind. So I would say that the stone is inside my head." "Your head must be feeling very heavy," declared Hogen, "if you are carrying around a stone like that in your mind." Do these resonate for you, these stories? Okay, then this is my most favorite one. Traveling dialogue for lodging. Provided he makes and wins an argument about Buddhism with those who live there, any wandering monk can remain in a Zen temple. If he is defeated, he has to move on. In the temple in the northern part of Japan, two brother monks were dwelling together. The elder was very learned, but the younger one was stupid and had but one eye. A wandering monk came and asked for lodging, properly challenging them to a debate about sublime teaching. The elder brother, tired that day from much studying, told his younger one to take his place. "Go and request the dialogue in silence," he cautioned. So the young monk and the stranger went to the shrine and sat down. Shortly afterwards, the traveler rose and went to the elder brother and said, "Your young brother is a wonderful fellow. He defeated me." "Relate the dialogue to me," said the elder one. "Well," explained the traveler, "when I held up one finger representing Buddha, the enlightened one, so he held up two fingers signifying Buddha and his teaching. I held up three fingers representing Buddha, his teaching, and his followers living their harmonious life. Then he shook his clenched fist in my face, indicating that all three come from one realization. Thus he won, and so I have no right to remain here." With this, the traveler left. "Where is that fellow?" the younger one, running into his elder brother. I understand you won the debate. Won nothing. I'm going to beat him up. Tell me the subject of the debate, asked the elder one. Why, the minute he came in and saw me, he held up one finger, insulting me by insinuating that I have only one eye. Since he was a stranger, I thought I would be polite to him, so I held up two fingers, congratulating him that he has two eyes. Then the impolite wretch held up three fingers, suggesting that between us we have three eyes. So I got so mad that I started to punch him, but he ran out, and that ended it. I love that story because of how we misinterpret and misunderstand very profoundly what somebody else is trying to say or do. So just a few words of my experience. As many of you know, I took Jukai last year, and Jukai is taking the precepts. And, you know, in Japan, if you take the precepts, you become a Buddhist. But true to things coming to America, things change. And people who take the precepts have various reasons for doing so. The two basic reasons would be, one, going deeper into one's practice, and two, examining and paying attention to our moral behaviors. Those are the two basic reasons people do it. And so it takes about a year, meeting with the teacher once a month, I believe. And Sensei Ray, what he did, besides having the class, he also had something called pods. And pods were informal groups of people that were taking the precepts that would meet informally when it was convenient to discuss where they were at. When we start exploring the Buddhist precepts, we speak about the three treasures, because that's the basis. The three treasures are the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. The Buddha, or interpreted as oneness, which is our awakened nature and the awakened nature of all things. Also, the practice of not knowing. Dharma, or diversity, which is the beginningless and endless ocean of wisdom and compassion. That is the practice of bearing witness. The third treasure is the Sangha treasure, the community of people who are practicing living out of these teachings in a harmonious way, and also the wider communities which include all beings and systems. This is the practice of healing, loving self, and others. These are the foundational principles and practices of the precepts, and receiving them are about a vow to make and take refuge in them. So sitting here today, we are taking refuge in the Sangha. We are the Sangha today. The precepts are the moral and ethical teachings of Zen and are considered core practices and the highest teachings of Zen. And within each of the precepts, the other precepts exist and unfold. The highest teachings is not only about emptiness and impermanence, but how do we embody them and live them out in our daily lives and in our relationships? There are 15 precepts in all, including three treasures, which I just mentioned, and the addition of three pure precepts, which are not creating evil, practicing good, and doing good for others. When we practice good, turn away from evil and in ignorance, and actualize doing good for others, then we begin to understand, become harmonious in the world, and we understand that it's better to give than to receive. We're in harmony with the natural order of things. The following six are the 10 grave precepts. Value and affirm life. Refrain from taking life. Practice generosity. Do not steal. Honor the body. Do not misuse sexuality. Manifest and express truth. do not lie. Refrain from using intoxicants. Do not delude the mind. Refrain from speaking about the faults and shortcomings of others. Refrain from praising yourself and downgrading others. Refrain from begrudging the Dharma treasure. Every phrase is the way. Refrain from anger, transforming suffering into wisdom. Refrain from reviling the three treasures. Why do we take refuge? We take refuge to deepen our realization of this reality. All the rituals and ceremonies are methods to express what exists beyond form and language. Just as today, in our last sitting, we will do chant service, that's what this is speaking of. It's a method to express what is beyond form and what is beyond language. A lot of times our intellect causes us a lot of trouble. The precepts are not commandments, though, about what to do or not to do. They are not a rigid set of rules. They operate instead in the spirit of gratitude, as they can illuminate the way we function, how we are functioning in our everyday life. And we approach it as in the spirit of exploration. The other thing is to pay attention to our behaviors, especially when no one else is looking. When no one else is looking, we're just doing. We're doing what we believe in. So in having, in the ceremony called Jukai, you also engage in the sewing of a rakusu. And perhaps if you've been to sittings at monasteries or other places, you'll see people wearing a rakusu. This is a rakusu. It has behind it the thing that we always chant. Vast is the robe of liberation, a formless field of benefaction. I wear the Tathagata's teaching, saving all sentient beings. And the teacher gives each of us a Dharma name. He gave me the Dharma name of Shodo, which means artisan of the way. It also has another meaning. On the back piece you see embroidered here is a pine branch, and that's the lineage. The lineage is the white plum, so we each have that. And the history of the rakusu originated in China, and it has like a field sewed, all little pieces sewed together as a field. And the legend is that when Buddha left his home to wander, he sewed little pieces of cloth together, and he ended up wearing those rags. So the rakusu is sort of symbolic of those little pieces when you sew this together. The other thing is that the first ones were made in China. You know, the political situation in all over the world, you can see the groups fighting with each other, you know, in Iraq, you have the two groups. Well, anyway, that has never been different, even in those many, many centuries ago. So in China, there was a time when Buddhism was like embraced, and the emperor was a Buddhist, and it was just fine to be a Buddhist. And then things would change. Buddhism was out. You couldn't wear your robes. You were persecuted if you were a Buddha, periods like that. So during one of those periods, a rakusu, this is the legend, was made, sewed by monks, and what they did was they wore it under their clothes so that they could continue to feel like they had their robes on even when they didn't have their robes on. So it's a symbolic robe, and in our practice, it is a symbol of a lay practitioner like myself practicing the way as deeply as I can. So that sort of tells you the story. And the ceremony is called Jukai. And if you read about it, from Dido Laurie, it's much deeper than the way I'm describing it. But every person does things the way they do things. You know, some people get married and it's extremely deep commitment and ceremony. And other people,
they jump out of an airplane together and that's it, you know, and they're happy. So, if anyone, any questions, we'll continue our sitting until we do our next kingdom. Thank you.